Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series is nearing its conclusion as the election itself draws near. Today it's issue 25, true or false, climate change can wait. The answer in Washington turns out to be true, as meticulously documented in The New Yorker in a fascinating blow-by-blow history of the failure so far of the cap-and-trade legislation, despite a bipartisan effort that also included both environmentalists and polluters. Ryan Lizza wrote the article called As the World Burns, How the Senate and the White House Miss Their Best Chance to Deal with Climate Change. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, well, thank you for having me.
You report that it was a source of dispute within the Obama White House whether to do energy reform first or put it behind health reform. Obviously, health reform won, but I want to play a clip of the president. This is actually from the one of the debates during the presidential race with John McCain, and he actually prioritizes. Listen.
Energy, we have to deal with today because you're paying $3.80 here in Nashville for gasoline, and it could go up. And it's a strain on your family budget, but it's also bad for our national security because countries like Russia and Venezuela and, you know, in some cases, countries like Iran are benefiting from higher oil prices. So we've got to deal with that right away. Healthcare is priority number two, because that broken healthcare system is bad not only for families, but it's making our businesses less competitive.
So, Ryan, you cited that clip in your article. In the campaign, the president said energy was going to be prioritized, as a family must make priorities as number one, healthcare number two. How'd they get flipped?
Well, and there were a couple other moments where he said something similar, and they got flipped, I think, and I didn't actually go into great detail in the piece in this, but I think the coalition around health care was stronger than the coalition around climate change. And that is that the groups within the Democratic Party and some of the important people were ready to go on health care in a way that the environmentalists and some of the business groups weren't ready on climate change. Remember, Ted Kennedy, when he endorsed Obama, one of the reasons he cited was that he knew that he thought Obama would be the president that could finally get universal health care coverage done. There was a lot of pressure from Ted Kennedy that health care go first. In Congress, there was an interesting split, too. The House wanted to do climate change first, and the Senate wanted to do health care first. And that split was mirrored in the White House. Some of the former Senate staffers were pushing for health care. Some of the former Senate staffers that joined the Obama White House were pushing to do health care first. And some of the former House staffers that joined the new White House team were pushing for climate change. And, you know, one senior administration official said that there really wasn't necessarily a choice to do health care first. But as he put it, you know, they were going to throw two things against the wall and see which one stuck. And health care was the one that stuck.
And kind of sucked all the political air out of the room for climate change or much of anything else for a good while. Now, you report that, nevertheless, by March of last year, just 2 months into office, as we all know, the Obama White House, trying to be postpartisan, had an outline for a grand bargain on a climate change bill. What were the basics of the grand bargain?
And it was pretty simple. I mean, there was a deal that anyone, any Democrat coming into office would have seen there. And a White House official described it as a grand bargain, like you say. And that is what Republicans want from an energy or an energy and a climate change bill is an increase in domestic production. So natural gas, offshore oil drilling, and then restarting the nuclear energy business in this country. And those are the three biggies for Republicans. And in exchange, maybe you could get them to agree to a cap on carbon, which is what which was the number one priority for the Democrats in an energy bill. You also would have to take care of senators from the coal states and a few other constituencies. But that was the main bargain: short-term increase in domestic production that Republicans would like in exchange for a hard cap on the carbon pollution that is causing global warming.
And you describe it as T. Boone Pickens holding hands with Al Gore.
Or actually, that was a line from a White House, the White House official who was describing to me. But absolutely, you got the oil, you know, the oil guy T. Boone Pickens and the ultimate environmentalist Al Gore. If those two sides of this debate, if they could come to some agreement, you'd have a deal. Now, ironically, I don't know if you were planning on getting to this. Ironically, you did get T. Boone Pickens and Al Gore supporting the Senate bill.
Yes.
Not literally holding hands, but they were both there in the end. And unfortunately, the grand bargain didn't come to fruition despite that.
But they never made the political ad with the two of them actually in there.
That's right. That's right.
Might have made a difference, as we heard from Brooke and Bob in our previous segment with the nature of political advertising today. So
yes.
Cut from the White House to the Senate, where much of your article is based, about the behind-the-scenes politics of Senators John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham, who had a left, right, and center climate change bill known as KGL, or Kerry, Graham, Lieberman. Why did Lindsey Graham, from perhaps the most conservative state in the Union, South Carolina, get involved with this at all?
You know, he's one of the most interesting characters in this whole thing. Look, Graham was not up for re-election this cycle, so I think he's got a sort of old-fashioned view of what a senator should be doing, and that is he's from South Carolina, obviously a very conservative state, but he's a deal maker at heart, and was genuinely saw the same grand bargain that the White House saw, and thought maybe he could step up, get some of his priorities taken care of, and his two big priorities were offshore oil and restarting the nuclear industry, and maybe he could. Maybe he could sort of make a name for himself as a modern day, you know, I don't know who the example would be, but you know,
yeah, somebody who crossed the aisle and did something significant.
Exactly, and he's tried to do this with Democrats
Ted
on a few other issues and hasn't really had much success.
Ted Kennedy, maybe.
Exactly.
But that's so interesting, and you know, it's one of the reasons that I loved your article is that you really got down into the nitty gritty politics of it. Lindsey Graham, trying to carry water for the oil industry and the nuclear industry, considers signing on to the to a cap and trade bill, and then later you tell us that even some of the oil companies, they approached the petroleum industry,
yes,
and some of those folks were for it. Now, how could an oil supporting senator or the oil industry itself support anything that would be cap and trade and see it as in its interest?
That's a good question, and Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman spent a lot of time trying to win over the interest groups that would be the most affected by this legislation. And specifically with the oil industry, they went to Shell, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Those are the three groups that they negotiated with. And Shell, BP, and ConocoPhillips brought them a proposal. They said, okay, we know that when our oil is burned in automobiles, it produces a lot of carbon, and so we need to be regulated under this cap-and-trade bill. But what if we came up with a sort of novel approach? And they worked out this basically a deal where the oil companies would pay essentially a nickel a gallon to the government, and that would cover the carbon that they produce, and that of course would be passed on to the consumer. So in the end, it really wouldn't affect the oil companies. And KGL liked that deal, and as part of that deal, the oil companies promised they would go to their trade group, the American Petroleum Institute, and they would do everything they could to make sure that the American Petroleum Institute stopped spending any money blasting and condemning cap and trade in political advertisements.
So oil, in theory, could still be hugely profitable in a carbon limited world.
It could be. Now you have a cap. You do have this overall cap on the economy of how much the carbon can be produced. So over time, it's going to be more and more difficult for everyone to use fossil fuels that produce carbon because the cap gets tighter and tighter every year.
Ryan Lizza, my guest on WNYC, the D.C. correspondent for The New Yorker. He wrote the article called As the World Burns, How the Senate and the White House Missed Their Best Chance to Deal with Climate Change. And before we get to how this grand bargain in the making, which sounds so optimistic so far in this conversation, fell apart, about Olympia Snow,
Yeah.
You describe her as the moderate Republican from Maine, known for stringing along Democrats for months with vague promises of joining their legislative efforts. And, of course, we saw it in health care.
Yep.
And in this case, you have her adding a new demand every time one of her old ones is met. Talk about Olympia Snowe and climate change.
She really frustrated Carrie Graham and Lieberman because they worked her extremely, extremely hard. Taking her out to dinner, Carrie and Lieberman sort of had that account, and they did everything they could. And they thought privately, they really thought that she would be there at the end of the day. But every time they went back to her, she had some new request. First, she wanted home heating oil. That's very important in New England. A lot of people use heating oil. And she wanted home heating oil, which is, which is when it's burned, it produces carbon. So that would be something that would be regulated under cap and trade. And she wanted that exempted from the cap and trade regime, which would have been a terrible precedent because she would have been carving out this major fossil fuel from cap and trade. And Carrie Graham and Lieberman, I don't think they ever entertained doing that, but that was one of her requests. At another point, she wanted an island off the coast of Maine protected from oil drilling. They were fine with that one. That one was easy. No one thinks anyone was going to ever drill oil on this island anyway. There were a couple other things. She wanted some help for small
and that's
businesses.
It says a lot about politics in general, either party. Okay, I'm for oil drilling. Drill, baby, drill. Drill here, drill now. That's the drill here, drill now party.
Yes.
Except off my coast.
Well, I remember Olympia Snowe, she's a moderate Republican. She's not actually part of that drill, baby, drill crowd. So that gets you into the complicated politics of this, right? Not every Republican is on the side
part of that.
Exactly. But to me, what it showed is also, what these guys were trying to do is stop runaway global warming. Not to be dramatic about it, but something that affects the future of mankind, right? And you get into these negotiations with the senators, and the concerns can be extremely, extremely parochial.
All right. Now, ultimately, it fell apart for a number of reasons, but you seem to say one big one was that the White House totally messed up by offering more offshore oil drilling unilaterally. We remember how just before the big BP spill, the White House was saying, yep, we're going to expand offshore oil drilling. And they did it unilaterally instead of waiting for it to be part of the grand compromise in the Senate bill.
Yeah.
What happened there?
According to Carrie Graham and Lieberman, this was one of the ways that sabotaged their effort more than anything else was that on three specific occasions, the White House just on their own announced things rather than making those announcements part of the actual legislation. So the White House announced that they were, as you said, they were opening up these various areas on the East Coast for drilling. At another point, they announced a huge sum of money for nuclear loan guarantees, which is very important to the nuclear industry to start building reactors. And at a third point, they delayed the implementation of some EPA regulations that Carrie Graham and Lieberman also wanted to use as a bargaining chip to get their legislation passed. So from the outside, it looked at, the White House is following through on their grand bargain. They're announcing all of these things that should be appealing to Republicans. But inside the Senate, what that did is it took away what the senators call their deliverables. Carrie Graham and Lieberman wanted those chips to cash in to get Republican support, and they viewed the White House as sort of giving them away.
Was that just a failure of communication?
I think it was two things. It was definitely a failure of communication because, for instance, Lindsey Graham didn't know about the oil drilling announcement until the night before. So there was really very little communication between them on that issue. But it was also a function of a White House that had engaged in that very nitty-gritty horse trading in the health care bill, where they were up there in the Senate doing these deals. And they felt that those deals actually backfired and caused a public opinion backlash against the president. If you remember, we were all talking about earlier this year, the Cornhusker kickback and the Louisiana Purchase.
Sure.
These very which, truth be told, are not all that unusual in Senate horse trading, but these things that became big public issues, and the White House suffered for being a part of that. So there was a debate inside the White House that those deals were harming Obama's brand, and they wanted to keep him away from them.
Now, you have public opinion as a factor, we should note. Ultimately, Americans believe that in this job-starved economy, climate change really can wait because they see that as a trade-off with jobs. But the final straw was an attempt to move immigration reform ahead of cap and trade back to the priorities to help Harry Reid's election effort because it would get a lot of Hispanics to turn out in Nevada.
Yeah, and that, and there were two things at the end, and they came right on top of each other. One was Lindsey Graham felt like the White House was no longer bargaining in good faith, and there was an article on Fox News' website that that cited White House officials, and it was tagging Graham arguing that Graham supported a gas tax in the bill, which wasn't quite true. Pushed Graham away. And then when Harry Reid out of nowhere said that that cap and trade was not going to be the next piece of legislation that he would move, it was actually going to be immigration, that was sort of it for Graham. And so Graham felt that neither the White House nor the Senate leadership was any longer bargaining in good faith, and he abandoned the talks, and no Republican stepped up to replace him. And that really was the end.
So in this article, you really took a deep look behind the scenes into what egos, and we didn't get into kind of the John Kerry and Joe Lieberman ego aspects of it, but those are interesting parts too.
Yeah.
And what special interests, as we did discuss, really drive policy making. Is there a moral of the story?
You know, if there's one moral of the story, it is the incredible power in Washington right now of major economic interests. And when you're trying to move legislation that affects as many sectors of the economy as cap and trade does, it makes it extremely difficult for the White House and Congress to move forward with that kind of regulation.
It is galling that in the Citizens United era, you kind of have to ask polluters permission to get them to stop polluting.
You literally do. And now there's an upside to that. On the one hand, you know, these guys have been spewing out carbon for decades because it's been legal to do so. And in fact, it's been the policy of the United States to build coal-fired power plants. So there is some sense, well, if you're going to make something that's been legal for a really long time illegal, it's not unreasonable to sit down with the regulated parties. But the balance of power has really gotten out of whack.
So just give me 30 seconds on what, if anything, you think can bring it back. Would it be a new balance of power in Congress after this election, or do we have to wait for the first all 100-degree month in farm country or something like that?
I think the sad thing on this is that this Congress doesn't move unless there's an immediate emergency. And what's really frightening about the global warming problem is by the time we're looking at an immediate emergency, most scientists believe it'll be too late to do anything about it.
Ryan Lizza, D.C. correspondent for The New Yorker, wrote the article called As the World Burns, How the Senate and the White House Missed Their Best Chance to Deal with Climate Change. Ryan, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Brian. I really appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Barbara Ehrenreich, our next guest. Stay tuned.